My name is Joe Barnt, and this session is entitled Fundamentals of Racism. There's a kind of a deliberateness to using the word fundamentals of racism, and there's always a fad about almost any subject that that you can name that somehow always gets around to the theme of back to fundamentals. you go so far with something, you go back to fundamentals kind of thing. And we've been having the rainbow weeks here for something like 10 days, now 9 days. And we decided it'd be fun to do a session on, and maybe more than one if it's needed, that sort of says back to fundamentals. It's been clear from several dimensions that it would be kind of exciting to do that. And so as a way of kind of introducing it, I put together my own list of why go back to fundamentals on racism. And you may want to add some of your own. So let me give my list of four reasons why it could be helpful and useful for us to go back to fundamentals of racism. And then I want to list a few of those fundamentals and let you pick up from there and do some discussion of it. My first reason for going back to for believing that it's necessary to go back to fundamentals as often as possible is illustrated by a tragedy that occurred, I believe, in Denver. I think it was in Denver. Not too long ago. It had nothing to do with racism, but with an airplane. It was the somewhat time this year, a massive airlines crash. Was there one in Denver? And that the reason, it may not have been Denver, help me wait until I remember Detroit. Which one it was.
It was Detroit, but they didn't have the flaps.
The one in Detroit, thank you. Detroit just walked in. and it was absolutely mind-blowing for the people who investigated that crash and for those of us who read the results of it to know that the reason that plane crashed is that the pilots plural forgot the most fundamental thing about flying: pull the flaps down while you're taking off. I remembered this, I thought of this when I was thinking about why go back to fundamentals of racism. Is that pilots have in their cabin a list of fundamentals. No matter how long you've flown, no matter how many thousand hours you've put in, when you're getting ready to take off, you can't depend on your memory and on the instinctiveness of remembering everything. You go down through the 25 things you have to check before you let the plane leave the ground. And they forgot one of the basic fundamentals and lost all those lives. The most fundamental of all: put your flaps down before you take off. I make an assumption in every group that I work with in dealing with racism that nobody here is a beginner. All of us are somewhere along the pathway of dealing with our own personal racism and dealing with the racism of our society. Some of us have flown high, some of us are just taking off, but we're all somewhere on the pathway. But no matter how high you've flown, how I've flown dealing with racism, I've just got to go back to some very basic kind of fundamentals that I just constantly forget. And not only that I just constantly forget because, like pilots, I can't remember all of the basics, but there's something about my racism that's been inscribed in me since early in my life that makes me want to forget it. It makes me want to forget some of the basic fundamentals of it. So there's got to be something of a discipline of constantly going back to the fundamentals. So that's one of my really important reasons for going back to fundamentals. Going back to such things like language, going back to such things as a couple of things that have come up today, but they constantly come up to me. The society constantly, the racism of our society constantly tries to tell me that my goal should be to be colorblind. That my goal should be to just simply no longer have color in our society. And people of color have been telling us over and over and over again, but I have to keep going back to my fundamentals to remember this, that there could be nothing more bland than a colorless, colorblind society. That God made the richness of color, the richness of culture, and that the goal is not colorblindness, but enhancing of color and making them all a valuable part and not a means of discrimination, but a valuable part. And so that, but the society keeps pressuring me to think otherwise. The society keeps, and sometimes the church, keeps pressuring me to make integration my goal. So, you know, would you please join my church and become a German like me? Would you please come and learn the Lutheran liturgy? And when you've learned it well enough, and when you've become European enough, then you too can become a Lutheran. I think our society keeps putting the concept of integration as a goal. And it's a fundamental of racism that that's not true. It's a fundamental of racism that nobody wants to integrate anybody, but that the richness of our colors and the richness of our culture do not make that old myth that the sociologist once talked about, a melting pot, be our goal, but rather a good mixed salad, a wonderfully brewed stew in which all of the parts are still discernible, still rich in flavor, rich in color, but not one that has overpowered the other in its flavor or its color. So those kind of basic fundamental things that, like the pilot taking off, you know, don't forget to lower your flaps. I get trapped by it all the time, the fundamentals. So the one reason for going back to fundamentals is that it is just simply because we all need our list to recall. The second reason that I think that we need to constantly go back to our fundamentals is that generations pass. And now you're talking to somebody who just remembers once in a while that he just turned 53 and next month is going to turn 54. It just passed like that. And that it was more than 20, 25 years ago when I started learning my fundamentals and still keep forgetting, but that as generations pass, I go into a group of either black teenagers or white teenagers and find out that even though that they may have learned a lot of the things about racial or justice struggles, they don't remember any, they've never learned any of the freedom songs. You know, the ones is just sort of, that just hearing one of them just makes me, the warmth and the fire start in me again. And then to go in with somebody who can sing better than I with a guitar and start singing them in front of a group of teenagers, and they're totally unlearned, not just forgotten. Forget the problem that so many of our fundamentals are forgotten, but that the generations pass and the songs have not been learned. And the fact that the songs have not been learned is part of our racism. Mm-hmm. Part of the fact that back in the late 60s and early 70s, we were finally getting black studies in the universities and the high schools. And not only for black kids to learn, but for white kids to learn and Hispanic kids to learn. But most of those black studies don't exist anymore. You know, so that the perpetuation of the message, of the song of freedom, is not taking place. So, and racism gets reinvented every week, every day, every minute amongst us. And that's the third, and I want to come to that third. Not only that we have to relearn our fundamentals, not only that new generations come and have to learn fundamentals, but thirdly, that in many, many, many ways, we're still at the very beginning. We can also talk about how far we've come, but in the last few months, always collect illustrations about why we're just at the beginning. My wife and I were on vacation in Maine, and we went over to Quebec for a stopover and came back into Maine, into the woods, and stopped at the first gas station because we're almost out of gas. And while the guy was pumping gas, there were six white teenagers leaning against the hood of a car, just out of hearing distance, just laughing. And I just sort of went over to see what they were laughing about. They were laughing about jokes about niggers and spics. it's like my high school days when I learned about and laughed about jokes about niggers and spics. You know, it was just like, you know, deja vu. It's 30 years later, and it hasn't changed a bit. California, 2 years, three, 2.5 years ago, took my confirmation class to a camping trip into a little town up in the foothills of the Sierras. And it was about a dozen kids, and there were about, I think it was probably about 8 black kids and 3 Hispanic kids and 1 white. And the counselors that were with me were all black, and we got out of the van that we went in there and at a little market to go in and do our shopping before we went to the camp, and we were surrounded within 3 minutes of getting out of a dozen men who said, "Get the fuck back in here and get your black asses out of here." And we didn't. We just considered ourselves lucky to get out of town. North Carolina, I went about 6 weeks ago. I was invited to make a speech at a racism conference with one of my heroes of the 60s and 70s, C.T. Vivian, alongside of him. And while we were at a weekend conference in Durham, North Carolina, there were 4 demonstrations by the Klan within 20 miles of where we were sitting. Including one involved some violent harassment of some children. And then that's not at all to mention the ones, you know, the illustrations of Howard Beach, the subway ride of Goetz. I just blocked his first name. Bernard Goetz, all of the university stuff that's been going. Anyway, third reason to go back to fundamentals is that we're fundamentally at the beginning of the struggle against racism. It gets reinvented every day. And then the fourth reason, and then I'll stop, and maybe you'd like to give some reasons before we list some fundamentals. The fourth reason is that we're not just at the beginning, we're also well progressed along the way of battling racism. We've come 25 years since the March on Washington, more than 20 years since the Civil Rights Acts and the Voting Rights Acts. And while there has been a lot of ways of demonstrating that we haven't come very far at all, it also, every time you eliminate one particular act of racism, racism just sometimes just gets deeper. But so our struggle has continued and makes progress, but somehow it goes deeper. But somehow it also amongst us makes a lot of progress. And how many of you are in the ELCA? Just tell me to have an understanding. And how many more are Lutherans of other brands and varieties? Okay. And then other Christians who are among us. In the evangelical Lutheran.
No, don't mind her. Hmm? One of us. I don't know what she was.
She could have transferred over dinner, you know.
She's being a baby, so people need to keep track of me, so I know who she represents.
How many of you are in the ALCA and don't know it? I'm not going to go into this much today, but we're going to have a session on it in more detail tomorrow. The the ELCA, and it's a model, it's only a symbol of the other churches struggling to do the same thing, has progressed to a level of new and exciting things. We have a new commission, a multicultural ministry that's, for the first time in the history of the Lutheran Church, provides institutionalized power for people of color. We have a commission on women that, for the first time in the history of the Lutheran Church, provides institutionalized power outside of women's auxiliaries for women in the church. For the first time in the Lutheran Church, we have constitutionally provided rules for representation so that there must be in every board and staff of the church specific representation of women, of lay people, and of people of color. A whole lot of new kinds of learning, new frontiers for us in the church. So another reason for going back to fundamentals is to make sure that we take those fundamentals into the new struggles that we're in. Well, they were the things that when I sat down this afternoon after Jody and I decided that would be the title, I said, okay, why go back to fundamentals? And so we started listing, and so there are four things. So you remember, when you take off, always to put the flaps down. Remember all those fundamentals before you go back into the next stage you're going into, and every one of us is progressing to new stages. Secondly, because generations pass and we have generations to teach, and generations that forget. And thirdly, because we're still at the beginning. And fourth, because we progressed a long way and are ready for some new kinds of battles. Now, I want to stop for a second. In a few minutes, I want to put down what I think are some basic fundamentals about racism that are just constantly my A, B, C, D, E. But maybe you'd like to just take 5 minutes or 3 minutes, whatever you need, to reflect on these reasons or your own reasons for why you go back to fundamentals on racism.
Joe, the global scene is why I feel the need to do that. I think what's happening in South Africa and the Philippines and other parts of the world have focused back to me the need to go back and take a look at you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And don't let us forget that it was Martin Luther King who first took into making the connections between racism in the United States and racism around the world, and now we've been taken to some very, very new levels of that with South Africa and Central America.
And we're very, I live in the city where I have, I guess, this first 4 months really feel a lot like I'm in South Africa. It's been a real jarring experience for me. It's the laws are there too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think our present administration has put us back 20 years.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, the decisions and busings and the attitudes of what did we call it? When you had to have so many blacks, what was
integration?
No.
Quotas.
There was another word for affirmative action was no longer truly existing.
Yeah,
or
right.
Administration has had a lot to do with the effect of changing the moods of people.
Okay. Both in the level of courts and on the level of legislation and on the level of the presidential executive, they just constant regression.
And it's been seen so blatant in the judges and things that he's chose to, that he wanted to represent the country.
Mm-hmm. Somebody else?
I would suggest that the gospel has to do with freedom. And as soon as racism is recognized, and it is, as a part of all of us, it is like handcuffs upon us, that we may be free with our feet to move here and there, but we are not free to reach out and to care and love and to share compassion, because our hands are cuffed. And that's the cuff of racism. And when we look at the global issue, we tend to step over the people who are at our doorstep as far as racism is concerned. The National Coalition for Homelessness, the Washington State Coalition for Homelessness tells us that pretty close to between 38% and 40% of the homeless people in America today are the ethnic minority people, most of them black. Most of them women with children. Now that is one of the most glaring fallouts of racism that exists among us. And we as white American Christians need to recognize that first and foremost. And that's an abuse of the gospel. It's a complete negation of the gospel. It's a, that's all it is.
Okay. Marty?
I see it this way, that it is more difficult for me to understand. However, the way I see it, it's an optical illusion that when we open up our eyes and we see a person, we have to immediately identify and classify that person a set of adjectives. And I think it should go back even more basic than that, not to classify, and not to really trust your eyes, because it could be an illusion.
Yeah. I've been finding that increasingly imperative to go back to the fundamentals of racism in addressing an issue like AIDS. It's similar to the model we've held up of homelessness. Because what we're finding with AIDS all across the country and on an international scope as well, that we're dealing not just with a disease, we're dealing with a social, political, economic phenomenon where all of the factors are interconnected, and at this point, indeed, the invisible persons who are suffering the most and will be impacted the most in the future are persons of color. And our systems of government, healthcare delivery, housing, child welfare, every single system that we have that should be at the disposal of persons with AIDS, persons affected by AIDS, is every system of that sort is designed in such a way that racism gets in the way of the delivery of those systems effectively to the persons most in need and most impacted.
I want to draw together those two things that came from over there and here. There's a sense in which we probably realize more than we ever have the degree to which racism infiltrates every issue.
Without saying what you think the fundamentals are, could you tell us maybe more what you meant by saying we need to go back to fundamentals? What does that mean?
Maybe that's a signal we should get into the fundamentals. Let's come back.
Just in order to answer the question whether or not it's a good idea to go back to fundamentals, I wanted to know what you meant by saying we need to go back to the fundamentals.
Well, I'm having a little difficult understanding the question. I listed some reasons to go back to fundamentals, and we need to get into the fundamentals. Do you hear you correctly what you're saying?
What does it mean to go back to the fundamentals?
What are the fundamentals?
Well, I don't necessarily want to know what are the fundamentals. Well, I guess that would be one way of answering the question.
I think what I'm trying to say, we got to get back to the ABCs. Some basic definitions. When we say racism, what do we mean by it?
Okay.
Yeah.
That helps.
Okay. Thanks for pulling my shirt tail about that. That's what I was intending to say.
Can I add one thing about that, which relates to this? I think one of the reasons for going back to the fundamentals is because we don't tend to see the fundamentals now as much as we did 25 years ago. That there's a way in which racism is more institutionalized than it used to be. It's still there and probably worse in some ways, and yet we don't see the blatancy of it, at least as much as, I mean, it's still there, as you were pointing out, but you don't have the, you know, you don't have the legalized segregation in the South like you used to. You don't have some of the...
Over there, then here.
It's important to me to get back to the fundamentals of racism because I'm a parent. And I need to really keep myself in touch and aware of those kinds of things so that I can keep my daughter in touch and aware. And so that, you know, your understanding of the youth of today using some of the freedom songs doesn't happen.
That's right.
You know, and not just music.
Part of that new generation, too. And Pete Perro likes to say, you know, we've all got part of the diabolical nature of evil is our amnesia. You know, we just love to forget. That's what "Do This in Remembrance of Me" means on every time we take the bread and wine. But that should, it's the beginning of our remembering what our basic life is about. Jody?
One quick note about the self-interest, it seems to me, Joe, of white folks, European descent. That it does seem to me there's a dawning recognition of what the numbers tell us.
Yes.
Right?
Thank you. Let's talk about self-interest.
That's right, absolutely. That there is a dawning recognition that this is one globe, and that the numbers on the globe say that only 11% of the people on the globe are of some kind of European descent, and 89% or 90% of folks are people of color. And that for both the people of color and for white folks, there's a it seems to be a self-interest in thinking about how it is we realign ourselves as sisters and brothers and are able to live together in some kind of way that we aren't currently doing.
Okay, a couple more, and then I want to get into the fundamentals.
Yes, what I hear is you're going back 25 years only. I'd like to know whether this goes back 200 years, 300 years, 500 years, what the church has done about it in the past, or have they done anything?
Or, you know, those who want to trace it all the way back to Cain and Abel, you know, how many thousand years. That's good. A very, very good thing to remind us of, because those of us who think the struggle started in 1954, you just have to really remember whose shoulders we stand on in order to be standing so high. The entire struggle of racism in slavery days itself and prior to it, and in the freedom days and in the development of Jim Crow and the whole sort of abolitionism on, and then where beyond that you want to go. Absolutely.
The church ever struggled against it then? I never heard anything about it, and I don't know.
Yeah, they sure have. There's always been, God has always called people to struggle. But there's also, as is today, there's also the church identifying with it, and supporting it. The entire colonialism period of Europe into the Third World was basically another... was the expansionism of international form of racism, in which, as everybody, you know, lives to the shame of, is that the cross went along with. But some of my greatest heroes were the ones who got crucified on that same cross and trying to make that not happen. So within, you know, yes.
I guess what I was asking was whether the church has taught us anything that we can go back to learn from them, and they're dealing with it centuries ago, probably.
Yeah. We need to be reminded of that. We're not going to touch on that tonight, but we need to work on that some more. Maybe I'll try, and when we do some of the church stuff tomorrow, bring some of that in.
Yeah, I've heard this gentleman here talking about the uniqueness of each individual person, addressing the fundamentals and the moral and spiritual values. Unless we do this, we are drug into a vast pit of mediocrity, and just everything is bland, like you say.
That's right.
And that's horrible.
That's right.
We need to address the fundamentals.
That's right. If we're going back to fundamentals, it's fundamental values of human relations that we're trying to trench ourselves into.
That's right.
Okay, last one, and then let's go into the fundamentals.
One issue that affects going from Portland, North Portland, spending the reason being a big game worker is really least focused on the racial issues in the neighborhood I work in.
You know, that's part of the history repeating itself. What goes around comes around, and can we re-equip ourselves to fight the same battles in new kinds of ways? What I'd like to try and do, and knowing full well before I even start that the superficial nature of trying to do fundamentals of racism in 1 hour is just a starting, stabbing point. But let me try to name what has been for me sort of A to E of some fundamentals about racism on which to hang some stuff. And I'll name them very quickly, or if you've just really got to put something in there, don't let me interrupt you. But let me just try, and then let's look at them and see if that's, once again, just as I did with the why fundamentals, see if that's the other ones you identify with, if you've got some more to add to, or if you want to either challenge the ones I've listed or add to it. But there's a, I'll try and even keep the illustrations down to a minimum until I get them all up so that we can look at them together. But the first one is that probably the most important jarring experience of my life were the experiences that made me realize how important it is to divide racism from the results of racism. Because we have been, there's nothing our country, I believe, is more unified around is we are willing to help with the results of racism. Every governmental program, every urban renewal program, every hunger program, every program for education and housing in which we can fundamentally agree with needs to be done and has got to continue being done, deals with the results of racism. It's Saul Alinsky used to tell the old story about rescuing babies out of the river, floating down the river until somebody finally decided to go up the river and find out who's throwing them in. One is that dealing with the results of racism always, almost always, so often turns out to be paternalistic kind of thing, let me rescue you type of thing, and not empowering. And so that we have to learn even though we're doing this. But the separating of that which causes victims to happen from victims dealing with their own situation and are being in support of that. It's very easy to distract us from thinking that we're dealing with racism by dealing with the results of racism. I'll just say that very quickly and move on to the second one. The second one is when you look at racism and ask, what is it? What is it we're trying to define? Almost everybody I know who's over the last two decades tried to deal with defining racism now comes up with a fundamental formula to define racism as prejudice plus power. Now that's shorthand for a lot of stuff, but it intends to say, first of all, that prejudice is not the exclusive property of white people. And prejudice isn't even always bad. And when it is bad, prejudice doesn't always hurt that much. But when you connect prejudice with the power to enforce it,
and even a power to enforce your prejudice without your even having, or I having to even take active part in the enforcement, racism takes place. And I have learned for myself to try and exclusively try and keep my definition of racism as something that has both of those two components. For me, that ends up saying that within the United States of America, white racism is the problem. Because it's the white system that has the power to enforce the prejudice. And no other system exists in the United States for enforcing prejudice but that. So the prejudice plus power in the United States then would equal white racism. Now, I'm really limiting that to the United States.
Joe, and also you want to add USA?
Pardon?
South Africa?
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, that's what I said. I want to limit to the United States. It can also be true in other parts of the world, and certainly is true in the Republic of South Africa. Certainly is true of the Republic of South Africa. The third thing, which has been fundamentally important for me to understand about the nature of racism, comes out of was exemplified in a lot of stuff that Pete Perro has been teaching us over the last few days. If some of you who are here are not so new around Holden to have not heard some of Pete Perro's stuff, and there's a lot of short terms for us, and I like to put it in terms of saying that racism is a prison for white people too. That one way of looking at the way systems work on racism to create victims is easy to just simply go to the analysis that says there's oppressors and oppressed and stop there. And it's really true. There are oppressors and there are oppressed. There are systems that benefit and reward one group of people, namely white, and that oppress another group of people, namely people of color. But to stop at that point doesn't explain racism, doesn't do enough to say that. And that and Pete likes to very, very clearly say that that you have to go back beyond defining the oppressor and the oppressed into understanding that we could take a vote here and say, anybody here who wants to be an oppressor, raise your hand. Anybody here who still chooses to consciously vote for any system that will give you privilege and not caring how many people it hurts, please raise your hand. And yet every person in this room is rewarded by a system that hurts people in order to benefit us against our own choosing. And so Pete goes on to make it very clear that there are people who know they are oppressed and people who don't know they are oppressed. And that's the two classifications. And that, approaching it from the sense of the Christian faith, is the basis for understanding of how people who are freed become those who become united under the cross to struggle against that which oppresses us all. I do not want my life to be used, whether it's my pension money in South Africa, or whether it's just simply my tax base in my community to reward me, or the police who protect my community to reward me at the expense of someone else. And yet they all do. And that makes me imprisoned by racism. And so that freedom, as Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass before him, and many others, before and after them, have said that when the oppressed get free, it will be the oppressor who finds freedom. Or how much freedom do you get when you have to hold a gun on somebody the rest of your life in order to keep things the way they are? Or an atomic bomb, whatever it is we need to do to keep things the way they are. So the third thing is that it's we who need freedom. Two. The fourth thing, and probably the most important of them all for me, and the one that takes most of our analytic time, if we had time to do analysis, is that there are two kinds of racism, personal and institutional, and it's institutional that does the damage. Now, you and I could be the most racist individuals in the world, and there's only a limited number of people that we can hurt. But put together an institution that'll do it for us in our name. Dick Gregory used to make the great, wonderful story about imagining an institution that functions in a racist way and then replaces each of the individuals who run that institution with people of color who carry out their job, and it still is a racist institution, still doing white racism. So as I said, the analysis, the analytical nature of racism has to be through understanding the damage, the sophistication, and the power of institutional racism. Not to at all take away the importance of us, each of us, dealing with whatever personal racism has been inscribed in us and whatever responsibility we have in our Lord Jesus Christ to become what some people like to call new white people, who have a whole new understanding of participation in society, but it's the institutional racism that does the damage. Then the next one is some friends of mine made a cube that puts on each side of the cube a different nature of things that oppress people. And over here is racism, and then over here is sexism, and here's nationalism and militarism, and here's classism, and here's ageism, and here is homophobia. So there's six examples of things you can put on a cube. And the illustration of this is that every one of them is interconnected. Every one of them. Somebody already raised the issue about how racism is inscribed on almost everything that we do. But that the things that hurt people are interrelated. And so something about the interrelationship of racism with all the other things that hurt people, locally and globally. Joe, you mentioned the whole global thing. And then finally, and I realize this is just going fast. I'm just naming fundamentals, and we can come back now and look at any one of these that you'd like to look in the time remaining, or add to them if you like, or say one of those isn't so. And the reason I put this last is this one is for me the taking us, propelling us past analysis of fundamentals into action. What are we called to do? And I think that that every one of us, as we go through our pathway of from our own enslavement in racism to freedom, pass through some kind of a set of movements. What are the things about grief? When you pass through grief, the stages of
developmental stages.
Pardon?
Developmental stages.
Developmental stages of grief, sort of developmental stages through the grief of racism, through its death and new life. We start off, every one of us, with ignorance. And I don't mean stupidity. I mean the original word of ignorance, of being made into not knowing it's true. Building in the amnesia. Passing through the knowledge of it, and oftentimes too many of us stop with guilt. And all the action that we do comes out, oh, it makes me feel so bad, can I help you, kind of thing. Passing through guilt, and if there's any group of people who should be able to pass through that, it's the Christians who receive the absolution and say, okay, you're forgiven, now what are you going to do?
into anger. It's one of the stages of grief too, right?
Into the kind of the training for passing. All of these we still take with us. Still got some ignorance with me. Still got my guilt I've got to deal with. I still feel really angry. But into the skill of action and responsibility. How do I strategize to bring about change and participate in a larger struggle? So it's the somebody has said, and I really think it's true, there is no such thing amongst us in the white society as a non-racist. And some of us spend a lot of our time somewhere down in here just trying to become one. You know, if I can reach the point where Janet will look at me and say, they may be all racist, but you're not one. You're okay. You know, then but you spend all of your energy in there. There's no such thing as a non-racist. There's only racists and anti-racists. But Jesus makes us into people whose confession of sin leads us into a positive confessing and resisting of racism into building something else. That's my list.
I think one word off of that. After ignorance, it should be denial before guilt.
Okay, thank you. All right. That's part of that. Good, thank you.
Sure. Can Carol? I ask a question? Is the stage in the process of anger, is that anger directed then at what you... with your new awareness of racism, then is it directed at racist kinds of things that you begin to recognize, or what? Where's
or
the
anger
at yourself?
A lot of it can end up being anger at yourself, which just feeds back into guilt. But no, anger at the system that both carries out racism in my name and has made me all these years and used me, made me into a racist and used me to be that. To be just angry and anger as part of this resistance, you know, resistance of the systems that do that. And anger, there's something about it myself that I still receive the rewards of it. You know, there's no innocence going to come. There's a forgiveness, yes, but there's no non-racist position that's going to come. That's my list of fundamentals. I'm willing to take as much time as you'd like as we got to for you to add to them, question them, challenge them, number seven, number eight, comment on them.
Is racism addictive and or contagious?
Sometimes in general.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the best analyses of racism I've seen deal with racism as a mental illness, and not just simply an individual mental illness, but the kind of psychopathic illness of a society. It certainly is insane. It cannot be studied scientifically except from the point of view of illness. One of the best analyses I've seen, somebody just gave it to me the other day, and it compares racism to alcoholism in terms of illness. And the article, I've got it here someplace, starts off by saying, "My name is Ed, I'm a racist." Those of you who have been to or experienced with Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the way you start off in AA meeting. "My name is Joe, I'm an alcoholic." And so you live with a constant struggle to become sober or to be a recovering alcoholic. And one way of our dealing with ourselves is to be seeing ourselves as recovering racists. And I think that's a very helpful model.
Is there any, for example, to carry this one step further, is there any type of medicine that can be taken?
Yes, bread and wine. There's something about this article makes me want to go back and review my 12 steps.
of dealing with alcoholism in terms of what it takes to be a recovering alcoholic and to deal with it. My qualms with AA, by the way, are that it only deals with alcoholism in terms of its individualistic, it has individualistic cures or ways of dealing with a socially cured cause disease. And so that I would have the same problem with that kind of analysis, that the way of dealing with a recovered racist is to become an active resistor on a public level. And AA does not recommend, it does not lead its recovering alcoholics into a public resistor of the causes of alcoholism. So the medicine, I would want to take a step further into what it takes to be collectively involved in the struggle against it with all the bread and wine you can get.
Joe, how come this over in the bookstore, I know you've seen it before, maybe you could just share with the group.
It's an article that's put out by the Council on Interracial Books for Children in New York, who have done some of the best work on definitions and resources of racism. And one of the originators of their first paragraph on definition of racism is prejudice plus power equals racism. So it's one of my mentors comes out of that group.
Well, I think that
is this for sale or available in the bookstore?
I believe that was the last copy, but on the back it says where to get additional copies.
Yeah.
And for us as individuals that are really interested in finding out for ourselves what we're actually dealing with, that article right here really gets down in the teeth of the definition, just as Joe has tried to do. And we should get these type of materials in our churches and in our communities that uses a tool to help us see within ourselves and outside of ourselves in society, and gives us something to work with.
I think this was over here first, and then I didn't see your hand back there. You
know, when you put down number four there, the institutional racism, that makes it kind of discouraging, kind of frustrating for me. It's such a large entity to work with. You know, I can do something more about my personal, but what can I do about the institutional? And being here the last couple weeks, the thing that struck me the most is how unfair the economic system is. I mean, the basis of capitalism is greed. And so you almost have to attack that. You know, we have the largest ratio of from the highest to the lowest paid people in industry is in the United States. Yeah, that's part of the secret of Japan.
Right.
And so, you know, but it's unpatriotic to attack capitalism.
That's right.
Yeah, know what they call that? Communism.
Yeah, and so you really can't take on the real institutional basis of it. If you don't have economic freedom, what good is political freedom? And so that's very discouraging to think about that for me, at least.
Yeah, I want to thank you for doing that. I had in my own notes to put down economics as the primary. I have two responses to what you just said. The first is that the primary, in terms of the progress we've made in the last 10 years, understanding the nature of racism, the primary level is to connect it with economic. Jesse Jackson in his speeches over the last few months, so, you know, the economic violence as the name under which you attack racism these days. But the second response I want to make to that is you started off your response by making it sound so big that you can't tackle it, and then going into economics has a tendency, if you start there, to really reinforce what you said. And so I'd really like to take you back to that first, take us back to that first, and say that, and talk about institutions, plural, and I'm referring to things like your congregation, the institution of your family, the institution of your fire department, the institution of
that it's not just one big institution, how in the hell can we take it on, but rather with an institutional analysis, the responsibility that we have to deal with our institutions. And so at least bring it down to the level where it's possible for us to have macro analysis, or whatever you want to call it, that does give us the larger picture, but then allows us to take on our institutions of our neighborhoods and our communities with our neighbors and friends. We're here, then we're
here. Yeah. There are some who say that alcoholism is basically a spiritual illness, and this is certainly true of racism, that it is predominantly a spiritual illness that pervades the individual. When people are spiritually sick, it makes the whole person very, very sick. And the only cure is, as you say, the bread and the wine, the gospel. If it comes to us again and again and again to turn us from racist to anti-racist.
Can I make a comment about that? I fully agree with that, except when it gets carried sometime by some of our people attempting to be faithful, who distort it and make it an exclusively spiritual thing. And I really believe that within alcoholism and racism, that the things that happened to me in my childhood, in my youth, and in my formation, that distorted, that put what some people's psychological analysis talk about, inscribing tapes, that is, makes spiritual be a much larger thing that deals with my with the mental state and the emotional state of my being, as well as my will, and so that it's dealt with both in terms of the spirit and the will, as well as dealing with the things that are truly inscribed in me that are at best, psychosomatic. I mean, truly part of my being, and but diabolical, spiritual too. Yes. Yes. Both together.
Nor, as you mentioned, in history has us knowing the gospel in the sense of just being literate in scripture or considering oneself a Christian been a sufficient antidote to racism.
I think that, I love to use the cure surrounding having to do with the central part of it being the bread and wine, but it's what gives me the will and the spirit to go into the things that are concrete, organizing, learning, intellectual and emotional explorations, and takes me into all of the other parts of my being to be able to deal with it. Marie?
I hope I can express this the way I'm thinking about it, but I've struggled a lot. I've been very confused about racism for many years, denying, I'm not racist, or what is, how can I fight it? That was the first big thing, without really understanding what was going on. And I think just in the past couple of years, I've come to understand, my feeling about myself, I really didn't feel very good about myself as a person. And I feel like a lot of white people don't feel good about themselves as a total, complete, whole being, or like themselves. And so all these isms that we talk about are really reflections of not accepting ourselves. And when I first heard Jesse Jackson, just as a very young person, maybe turning 20, saying, at the top of his voice, I am somebody, and I felt very much rejected, not by him, but I felt, that was for the black people there. And I think in recent years, I think white people need that very much before they can even deal with the completeness of another person. I feel that, maybe I'm projecting my own feelings, but I feel that.
A lot of racism comes out of personal insecurities.
We're going to be able to take two more questions.
questions, but I just want to reemphasize that as sort of the end piece before we, because the bell's going to ring in a second, so that this becomes a conclusion, even though we'll have time for a couple more things. And that is that we've got probably the biggest fundamental is the one we started off with, is that dealing with racism is changing us. And the biggest part of racism is the confusion into leading us to believe that dealing with racism is changing black people or changing people of color. It's changing us. Carol and then Janet.
It seems to me that that racism or any other kind of ism is an attempt to create a hierarchy of which I'm a superior to someone. And that feeds in with the comment over here about basic insecurity. But it does it on a larger scale than just my own personal scope. But perhaps maybe there's another element to that, but it seems to me that whole nations can feel superior to other nations, or whole races feel superior to other races or classes.
Yeah. And the interrelationship of racism and nationalism. So
and sexism.
Profound, yes. And sexism. Yeah. All of it. The whole cube.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I really think that we really should take this serious and take it back to our churches and to our communities. We're living in a time of really major crisis. We are seeing the openness of the Klans, the neo-Nazi groups, the survivalists, the skinheads. I mean, we turn on TV and see programs like Oprah, and the skinheads are on, and how nasty and how open and how vicious. And these things used to be kind of things that were kept undercover. We see the farmers and the farm belts now blaming the Jewish people for taking their money because of the banks and things. I mean, racism is at one of the highest points it's ever been, and it's no longer hidden. And if we as church people and as Christians can't help to stop the tide, we're in trouble, real trouble. I mean, it's almost to the point you can almost see how Hitler got his reign going, because whenever times are bad, and I don't care what the economy says, times are bad. And they always turn against and want to put the blame on someone else.
Gotta find somebody to blame. Mm-hmm.
And we are living in those times. I mean, this is not just a friendly conversation because it's Rainbow Week. I mean, this is life. This is bread and butter.
Well, since then we're so quick guy in the tech company. For me personally, once I read this paper, and what it made me understand was you had to have components to be a racist, to be a sexist, to be an ageist, and we won those isms on the cue. And if I wanted to be a sexist, I have to have those components which makes me a sexist, the prejudice and the power. So in order to make sure that I am not a sexist, take one of those components out, for instance. Take out the prejudices against sex, and you can't be a sexist.
How?
let me make that something that everybody here would like to answer, having just been said. An invitation, the basis of an invitation to make this another in beginning for this second week of Rainbow in the second week of Rainbow for all of us to really be exploring this level of our society and of our lives. Tomorrow I'm going to do a Bible study, and can the Pharaoh be saved? It's on Exodus. And there'll be, throughout the week, opportunities for us to be doing this and asking the question of white response. Is white a color in the rainbow? What do we do? How do we re-equip ourselves for the struggle? against racism and all its interrelated things. Thank you very much.